Before we read a word of context, Matthew chapter 9, beginning with the 35th verse. By the time we get to this portion of Matthew, Jesus has been very, very busy. He's been teaching, healing, calling disciples, casting out demons, engaging the religious leaders in debate. And then he calls together his disciples and speaks specifically to his chosen 12 and sends them out into the world to expand the work that he has already been doing. And there are two things in this passage that might catch your ear as you listen or might trip us up that I thought might benefit from a word of explanation. First, Jesus' instructions to the apostles are to go only to the Jews. And as we are Christians, some folks might wonder, what is that direction from Jesus about? I don't want you to trip over that. That instruction from Jesus to his apostles to go only to the chosen people of God, the Jews, is a reflection of Matthew's clear message that Jesus is the Messiah that God had sent to the chosen people and had promised always to send. Jesus is the fulfillment of the prophecies that came to the ancient Jewish prophets. So the Messiah comes first to God's chosen people, the Jews, and that is Jesus' clear instruction here in Matthew. At the end of Matthew's gospel, if you look at the 28th chapter, what you hear then is Jesus telling those same disciples and apostles to go to the ends of the earth. So don't let that trip you. And then the second thing that might catch your ear as we read this together is that Jesus calls down judgment on those who will not show hospitality to the good news or show hospitality to the apostles that he sends. And he references an old judgment story from Genesis chapter 19, where the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah are destroyed because they refuse to show hospitality to Lot, who is Abraham's nephew. Scripture remembers, and in multiple places, not just here in Matthew, but remembers and interprets the story of the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah as a story about the refusal to offer hospitality, not as a passage that instructs us on homosexuality, as is sometimes mistakenly believed. Matthew understands and tells us that hospitality given to the ones that Jesus sends gives us life. Lack of hospitality to those sent by Jesus brings death. The judgment is very real, but I think it's worth reminding ourselves about the purpose of the reference to Genesis is about hospitality. So with those two explanations, let's listen in as Jesus gives instructions to his disciples who are sent into the world. Then Jesus went about all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues, proclaiming the good news of the kingdom, curing every disease and every sickness. When Jesus saw the crowds, he had compassion for them because they were harassed and helpless, like sheep without a shepherd. Then Jesus said to his disciples, "The harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore, ask the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest." Then Jesus summoned his 12 disciples and gave them authority over unclean spirits to cast them out and to cure every disease and every sickness. These are the names of the 12 apostles. First, Simon, also known as Peter, and his brother Andrew. James, son of Zebedee, and his brother John, Philip and Bartholomew, Thomas and Matthew the tax collector, James, son of Alphaeus, and Thaddeus, Simon the Cananean, and Judas Iscariot, the one who betrayed him. These 12 Jesus sent out with the following instructions: go nowhere among the Gentiles and enter no town of the Samaritans, but go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. As you go, proclaim the good news: the kingdom of heaven has come near. Cure the sick, raise the dead, cleanse the lepers, cast out the demons. You received without payment, give without payment. Take no gold or silver or copper in your belts, no bag for your journey, or two tunics or sandals or a staff, for laborers deserve their food. Whatever town or village you enter, find out who in it is worthy and stay there until you leave. As you enter the house, greet it. If the house is worthy, let your peace come upon it. If it is not worthy, let your peace return to you. If anyone will not welcome you or listen to your words, shake off the dust from your feet as you leave that house or town. Truly, I tell you, it will be more tolerable for the land of Sodom and Gomorrah on that day of judgment than for that town. See, I am sending you out like sheep in the midst of wolves. So be wise as serpents and innocent as doves. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. For as long as I can remember, Jesus' words here in Matthew about the harvest being plentiful and asking God to send laborers out into the harvest, Jesus' words have been interpreted as a call to leave home and to go make disciples of outsiders. Whether they wanted to be disciples or not, we didn't ask. We were supposed to go and make disciples of other nations and other peoples. And the Western Church, since the time of Constantine, has taken a rather consistently domineering approach to spreading the good news, sometimes literally at the tip of a sword. But one of the things that struck me about this week's readings is that Jesus' words are not spoken to foreign peoples or to other nations who are not like us. Jesus' words here are to his own people. And the first thing this passage reminded me of this week is that before Jesus sends us as apostles out to do harvesting in the world, Jesus sends us first to our own house, to our own church, to our own faith to get things in order. The kingdom of heaven has come near in the person of Jesus Christ, and we are to proclaim that good news where we are at home. So before we do the gospel to somebody else, we are to tend to our own hearts, our own churches, our own communities. The harvest is plentiful right here. And good news and disciples need to be made inside the walls of our church. The second striking correction to how this phrase about being sent into the harvest has been traditionally interpreted is the context, is to remember the context in which Jesus speaks this mission. Jesus looks at the crowds all around him, and Matthew says he feels compassion. The Greek word literally means to have our stomachs, our insides knotted up, a physical manifestation of the pain and suffering that we see other people bearing. So because he suffers with the crowds, Jesus meets the crowds where they are, and he brings good news to their bad news. So if they're sick, Jesus heals. If they're hungry, Jesus feeds. If they are ill, Jesus heals. If they are afraid, Jesus stills and calms the storm. If they're confused, Jesus teaches. And now the disciples are sent, for that's what apostles, again, literally means, to be sent to bring good news to bad news. Jesus sends the apostles out of compassion for the crowd. The world that we live in also is hurting and confused and troubled and helpless, like sheep without a shepherd. And Jesus reminds us that in that context, the essential Christian response is compassion. You and I, when we call ourselves disciples of Jesus, what that means is that we go into the world in a spirit of compassion, not domination, not to prove ourselves more right than other religions, not to gain accolades or praise, not to be able to brag about how many people we have brought to Christ. Disciples of Jesus go into the world, even into the middle of fearful, hurting, confused crowds, and we do it in a spirit of compassion. In compassion, again, a Latin word, the prefix com, meaning with, and the other portion of the word passion to mean suffer, literally. So compassion means literally to suffer with. Jesus saw the crowds with compassion. He was willing to suffer with them. When we see crowds on TV, in our cities, who are hurting and helpless, how do we feel? And can we see those same crowds with the compassion of Christ? Going into the world as Jesus' apostles means that we go willing to suffer with the crowd. Being sent out of compassion, the compassion of Christ, has nothing to do with protecting our privilege or staying safe or a spirit of domination. To be a disciple of Jesus is a very distinctive countercultural way of being in the world. And if we call ourselves disciples, then Jesus here calls our names and sends us. And we decide if we are willing to move from disciples who sit and learn and follow to apostles who are sent to bring good news to bad. Our faith in Jesus necessarily involves us in the struggles of the world. Our faith in Jesus involves us in risk. It means that our lives will be a bit uncertain and dangerous, and that faith allows us to tolerate some of that uncertainty. And if not, then it's not Christian faith, it's faith in something else. In fact, Jesus tells his disciples, now he calls them apostles, that they will be rejected at times. The passage that was assigned for this Sunday goes all the way to almost the end of chapter 10. And there's a lot of more material in the passage that was assigned by the lectionary, but I chose to stop at verse 16 because there was so much to study and to interpret. But if you read all the way down to the end of the lectionary passage, which takes us to chapter 10, verse 23, then what you read is that Jesus asks his disciples, apostles, to risk and to suffer and to be ready to experience rejection. So in the space of just a couple of verses, Jesus teaches us that the key marks of the good news, of the Christian good news, are one, that it always brings good news to bad news and it meets the needs of the crowd. Two, that good news is not transactional. We don't expect pay for sharing it. We give to the world for free and without cost that which we have freely received in the grace and mercy of Jesus Christ without cost. Compassion and mercy and forgiveness. Three, Jesus teaches us that the gospel of Jesus Christ is always given in a spirit of compassion, not domination or control. And fourth, Jesus tells us to expect that this kind of good news is often rejected by the very ones to whom we are sent to love, the very folks with whom we suffer. And because that is the reality of being sent into the world by Jesus, Jesus also warns us. He says, "See, I'm sending you out like sheep in the midst of wolves. Be wise as serpents and innocent as doves." That is such a striking description of what we are supposed to be that I just decided we needed to stop reading right there. What in the world does it mean to be wise as serpents and innocent as doves? I think if we think about it a bit, I certainly know many Christians that I have known personally who have been rooted in compassion for the world and who've been faithful in that willingness to suffer with, but not naive. We know those people who are loving but not weak. But as I was thinking about how to explain, what do I think that Jesus means when he calls us to be wise as serpents, innocent as doves? The most timely explanation of that phrase is given to us in a sermon that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. preached called "A Tough Mind and a Tender Heart," in which that very verse 16 is his text. If you haven't ever read "A Tough Mind and a Tender Heart," I recommend it to you. I have it or read it in a collection of Dr. King's sermons called "Strength to Love." And in that sermon, "A Tough Mind and a Tender Heart," Dr. King defines a tough mind, what we're supposed to have, this way. He says a tough mind is characterized by incisive thinking, realistic appraisal, and decisive judgment. A tough mind is sharp and penetrating, breaking through the crust of legends and myths, sifting true from false. The tough-minded individual is astute and discerning. He has a strong, austere quality that makes for firmness of purpose and solidness of commitment, he wrote. And then he writes about the opposite, the less desirable, what we don't want to be, and that is soft-minded. And Dr. King said, the opposite of a tough-minded person is a soft-minded person. And a soft-minded person, he wrote, always fears change. He feels security in the status quo, and thus has an almost morbid fear of the new. For the soft-minded, the greatest pain, Dr. King wrote, is the pain of a new idea. An elderly segregationist in the South is reported to have said, "I have come to see now that desegregation is inevitable, but I pray God that it will not take place until after I die." The soft-minded person, wrote Dr. King, always wants to freeze the moment, hold life in the gripping yoke of sameness. Soft-mindedness often invades religion. That is why, he wrote, religion has sometimes rejected new truth with a dogmatic passion. But for Dr. King, being tough-minded was not enough, because he also understood and believed that the gospel of Jesus Christ demands also that we have a tender heart. And by this, he means that we exhibit the same compassion that Jesus here exhibits in Matthew's gospel. And so he starts in the sermon by describing the opposite of a tender heart, or what a hard-hearted Christian might look like. And he says that a hard-hearted Christian lacks the capacity for genuine compassion. He is unmoved by the pains and afflictions of his brothers. He passes unfortunate men every day, but never really sees them. He gives dollars to a worthwhile charity, but he gives not of his spirit. And then Dr. King goes on to reference the story of Dives and Lazarus, or the rich man and Lazarus, in Luke's Gospel, chapter 16. And Dr. King writes that the rich man, Dives, was condemned not because he was not tough-minded, but because he was not tender-hearted. Life for Dives was a mirror in which he saw only himself, not a window through which he saw other selves. Dives went to hell not because he was wealthy, but because he was not tenderhearted enough to see Lazarus, and because he made no attempt to bridge the gulf between himself and his brother. Brothers and sisters in Christ, whenever we call ourselves disciples, whenever we claim to follow Jesus, to be formed by the teaching of Christ, then what we believe is that Jesus calls us each by name and sends us as apostles into a world that is hurting and confused and angry and grieving. And we are called to go into that world in a spirit of calm plus passion, willing to suffer with those in the crowd. A faith that is not both tough-minded and tender-hearted. A faith that does not involve us in the struggles of the world. A faith that does not inform and transform how we spend our time and our money, how we treat other people, how we view our economics and our politics. A faith that does not do those things is at best immature, and at worst is a pietistic cover for selfish indulgence. Now, that doesn't mean that all of our politics or all of our economics have to match. What it means is that our faith guides and forms our economics and our politics, not the other way around. If compassion and a willingness to suffer are not the lived results of our faith, then we run the risk of rejecting the only good news that can save us.